Welcome to Mastering Logical Fallacies, the online course. This is the audio version of the online course presented at MasteringLogicalFallacies.com. For the complete learning experience, including multimedia presentations, quizzes, assignments, peer-to-peer discussion, instructor interaction, and more, enroll as a student at MasteringLogicalFallacies.com. My name is Beau Bennett, and I am your instructor for this course. The multiple comparisons fallacy is another fallacy very common in social research. There are two general aspects of this fallacy. The first one is when we look at a bunch of similar studies, and what we do is we just pick out the statistically probable odd results, and we report those results as if they were common. Or as, hey, study, this is what the study found. And this is really deceptive because of the confidence level and of probability, the way things work. So let me describe a statistical study that we're doing. And let's say that we want to know how many people who go shopping leave garbage in their shopping carts after they take out their bags and put it in their car. So we do a study. We're out there for weeks taking meticulous notes and keeping track of everybody who leaves junk in their cart. And we find that one out of every 20 people will leave junk in their cart. Now, let's say we have some kind of strange bias and we want to prove to people that people leave crap in their carts. So we would write an article saying, study shows that shoppers leave stuff in their carts. This would be true in one sense because the study did show that shoppers do leave stuff in their carts. However, it would be incredibly deceptive because the study actually showed that only 5% did, or 1 out of 20 people did. So for the most part, the study shows that people don't leave things in their cart, for the most part. So that's why when you're comparing multiple samples, all the individual cases, every person that actually left something, and you're just taking a fraction of that, you're committing this fallacy. Now, the other aspect of this fallacy is when you're basically looking at a sample and you're collecting a whole bunch of information and you're really just kind of shooting in the dark. You're just looking for anything. So that's why you're comparing multiple things, and then you're just taking the one thing that is different, and you're using that to justify the problem or the research problem. So, for example, let's say that we're looking at a sample of cancer patients. So here's 100 cancer patients, and we want to find out what do all these cancer patients have in common that could possibly be the reason for their cancer. So what we do is we create a study that asks 500 questions. I mean, questions about everything that you could imagine. I mean, just total random questions. Now, based on probability alone, one of those questions at least, we're bound to find that a lot of people will answer that, will have the same answer in common. Whereas most of them, they probably won't. And this is just out of pure statistics. People are bound to just answer the same question in the same way. But we don't know what question it is. That's why it's important in research. We need to create a hypothesis beforehand. So we have to say what we're looking for. Then we design the experiment or the survey or the whole research program around that specific question. And we look for that specifically. But if we don't do that, and we just go for anything, shoot in the dark and go for a whole bunch of random information and then look and see what people have in common, well, that could be purely due just to statistical probability. And now if we take that statistical anomaly and we say, this is why they all have cancer, this is what they have in common, therefore this must be why they all have cancer. That would be fallacious. That would be committing the multiple comparisons fallacy because we just basically drew something at random by looking for an anomaly in the data, which isn't helpful at all. And once again, the way to get around that basically is designing the research proposal and having a hypothesis beforehand. Now, I don't want to give the impression that that's necessarily a bad thing, just asking tons of questions and find out what somebody has in common. The fallacy there is once you get that information, assuming that that is the cause of the cancer or that has something to do with the problem at hand. What we would do, and this is what many people do in a qualitative study. In a qualitative study, you're just asking a whole bunch of questions to kind of see, to get a theme and see what themes emerge. And that's okay. But now you take that information that you get, those themes, and then you design a study specifically around that, and then you test that hypothesis. So if we were to do this initial study of the 100 cancer patients, we find out that out of all 100 cancer patients, 80 of them happen to eat peanut butter at least once a day. Now, that would be kind of crazy, but statistically, if you ask enough questions, you're bound to find something crazy like that amongst the whole group. So we say, okay, now we got something. Now let's test the hypothesis that eating peanut butter at least once a day will lead to a higher rate in cancer. Now we've got something to work with. Now, there's no way we can make any claims at this point, but we can make a testable hypothesis. Then we could put together and design a study that would actually test that. And now we look at a different group of patients, specifically on the whole idea of peanut butter, and see if that specific group is more likely to eat peanut butter once or more a day. And then we could make some conclusions based on that. But until we do that second follow-up study, then we would just be committing the multiple comparisons fallacy, making those kind of conclusions. Unfortunately, statistics can be incredibly manipulative. We are visual people. Most people tend to be visual in that whenever we see a graph or a chart or something, it adds more power to just the data itself or the numbers itself. So if somebody is making an outrageous claim or just even a claim that's just not true, and they have some kind of chart or graph or figure to give support to their statistical claim, then we're basically just more likely to believe it because we believe statistics or they have some kind of magical power over us. But as we have seen so far, we should have seen that statistics can be manipulative. Statistics are just numbers in themselves and data. However, people can report them in a misleading way and misreport them. I want to stress that a lot of the misreporting, a lot of the error and the exaggeration and the outright deception comes from the media and not the actual scientific papers themselves. The far vast majority will come from this, from the media, from biases of journalists or certain media stations that they have that report data in the way that they want to deliver a message, just by selecting the data and so forth. So it's always a great idea to go back to the original study. So when it comes to lying with statistics, what you're basically doing is you could take the actual data and you can just manipulate it in a way, in the way that you show or the way that you choose to display the data in order to send a very different message. And that's what we're talking about with lying with statistics. It's a fallacious way of representing the data itself. The example that I use that's very common in the book is when you're presenting data and you're presenting it, let's say, in a bar graph, and you want the spike or the jump to look a lot bigger than it really is. Instead of presenting the graph starting at zero and going all the way up to the highest number, let's say it's like 1,000, And the jump was really, let's say, 900 to 1,000, which is like a 10% jump. You get rid of everything from zero to, let's say, 900. And now you have a scale that goes from 900 to 1,000. And then that jump is huge. It's the entire height of the scale. And you could see how that looks very different than a jump that's only 1/10 of the scale. So it's the same exact data, the same exact numbers, the same exact statistics. It's just shown in a different way in order to make that jump look more significant than it actually is. So my advice when it comes to looking at statistics visually, when it's presented and represented by graphs and charts and so forth, look at the numbers themselves and just think about the numbers and what they represent and try to think about it mathematically and statistically rather than visually, and you will get a better sense of the importance or the lack thereof of the data being reported. The Ludic fallacy is basically using statistics and probability in place of common sense. Or I guess another way to put it is using it in such a way where statistics and probability really can't apply because there is just way too many unknown variables. One example of this is a debate that I saw a few years back between somebody called William Lane Craig and Bart Ehrman. Both of these guys were debating the existence of God. And William Lane Craig had a presentation, a PowerPoint presentation, trying to show and prove God's existence mathematically. In a way, this was kind of humorous, and Dr. Bart Ehrman even called him out on this, saying, are you really trying to prove God mathematically? And the reason why this is kind of humorous is because it's just such a silly concept to do something like that. And it's part of the Ludic fallacy. It's a perfect example of the Ludic fallacy because you can't possibly know all of the variables that would go into such a calculation. And anything that you could come up with is just really ad hoc or post hoc or just something that you're throwing out there to really work the numbers in your direction. I think to proving anything, if we want to take God out of the picture and just prove that ghosts exist or prove that fairies exist or something like that, we could come up with a really silly formula that tries to prove something statistically or with probability theory. But you just really can't do that. You can't do it without getting into absurdity. Just because we don't have all the information. We're going from a purely naturalistic sense where we could actually apply numbers and probability to things into the sense of the supernatural and the unknown, where none of which has any kind of probability or numbers associated with it. So that's essentially what the Ludic fallacy is, and you could look for that when people try to support an argument with numbers where numbers really don't apply, and that's that they're trying to pull one over on you when they do something like that. The hasty generalization fallacy is very similar to the biased sample fallacy we were talking about before, but instead of actually just choosing a biased sample, that is a sample that's not representative of the population due to the characteristics within the sample, for example, like all high school freshmen instead of different students from each grade, when we're talking about hasty generalization, we're talking about using a sample size that is way too small to make a generalization to the entire group. Statistically, this is common. If we just say like 4 to 5 dentists recommend this gum, and how many dentists did we ask? Well, we asked 5 dentists. Okay, that's not really enough to make a claim about all dentists. You'll see this very commonly in anecdotal information. In anecdotes, when somebody tries to present an anecdote as evidence to their claim. So they say, for example, like, you know what, I ran a marathon and I'm okay, and therefore you could run a marathon too. It's like, okay, well, you ran a marathon. Good for you. You're very different than me. And if we were to do a study with 1,000 people running marathons that are all our age, and then we could get a better sense of how many people could actually make it based on that data. So we see this fallacy a lot when people just take one specific anecdote and try to generalize that to a global claim and make a claim about the population. And it's basically the heart of the weakness of anecdotal information is this whole hasty generalization fallacy. Fake precision is a very simple fallacy. It just has to do with creating a number that is so unrealistically precise for the purpose of misleading somebody into believing that number is more true than it actually is. And I think that's probably a concise definition. And it has to do with the person actually making up the figure or giving an exact figure to with the understanding that he or she will be deceiving the person in such a way and making them assign more credibility to that number than it actually deserves. That's where the real fallacy comes into place. Now, the reason behind it, why do we associate more credibility with a specific number than a more general number? It probably has to do with just the way that we tend to round figures in casual conversation. When we are talking about numbers and figures, we always understand that there is some kind of buffer to it. So if we say that a million people did something, we might have got that number from a study that showed 1.12653 million, and we just rounded that down. We say a million people. So we understand when we round it down that there's some wiggle room in there. However, if we were to give a precise number, it gives the appearance that that is the answer, and there is no wiggle room. It's not about a million, but it's exactly 1.32 whatever million. We tend to like exact numbers, and we favor exact numbers over round numbers, even though round numbers may be closer to the truth, and they may have better justification for the round numbers. But yet, we still have this tendency to favor exact numbers. So when somebody uses that tendency against us, they're committing the fallacy of fake precision. We see the biased sample fallacy occur most often in social research. That's any kind of research dealing with people. And the reason for that is because of the sample. The biased sample fallacy is all about the sample taken. And when we're talking about social research, we're talking about taking a sample of individuals, of groups of people. The basic fallacy surrounds the idea that the sample taken is not truly representative of the population that the survey or the article or the person speaking or whomever is making it out to be. So, for example, a biased sample can be very common in social research because you can't get a perfect sample from a population. Now, just to back up a bit, when we're talking about a sample from a population is the entire group being studied. So if we are looking to survey all the high school kids in one certain high school, if we want to make draw a conclusion about all of those high school kids in one high school, that is the whole population, the entire high school, all of the students within the high school. It may be not practical to research every single student and to survey every student and get their opinion and get them to sit down and answer a survey, a question, or so forth. So what we do in those cases in social research is we survey a section of that population, a sample of the population. Now, how are we going to draw that sample? Well, if we wanted to get a realistic view of the entire population, if we wanted to draw conclusions based on the whole high school, like what high school students think, that's the way we might word it in an article or in a write-up. What we need to do is we need to make sure that the sample we get is representative of the entire population. The best way to do that is through a totally random process where we get a large enough sample that would statistically represent the population. We're not going to go into that right now. Just realize that there are specific formulas and tools to be able to get an exact, not an exact sample size, but a decent sample size, something that would be good enough to represent the entire population. And there are formulas for that. But besides just the number, we need to make sure that the people within the sample are representative of the entire population. So by doing something randomly, we're assured that there's going to be no human biases. So we, for example, we don't pick too many freshmen, or we don't pick too many people that we like or that are like us or that happen to want to take the survey or smile at us. I mean, there could be literally hundreds of different factors that get in the way of making it a truly random and representative sample. But once again, in social research, that doesn't always work out. And that's not the fault of researchers. It's not bad methodology. It's not a bad study. Sometimes you just can't get a purely random sample. And sometimes you don't want one. So for example, if we were to get a purely random sample and of, let's say, 100 students, and for some reason, statistically, we got 80% freshmen, which could happen, then we're not looking at something that's truly representative. It was random. It was kind of strange that we got that many freshmen, but it's not what we want. So what we might do is we might take just a random sampling of each grade. And that's another way of breaking it down a little bit. But sometime with bias samples, the whole idea behind bias sample fallacies is that we're getting and choosing our sample based on some kind of bias. So, for example, with this high school example, if we were to get, let's say, only seniors, because we're a senior and we know seniors, and we left out juniors, sophomores, and freshmen, well, of course, we're going to have a biased sample. If we're male and we don't like talking to girls because they scare us, and we just get all males from different grades, then we have a biased sample. So we can't do a study based on all men, all boys within high school, and then say that's representative of the whole high school. That just wouldn't be fair. That would be a biased sample. So if we were to make the claim, let's say how this fallacy is committed, if we were to make the claim that high school students believe this, and yet we had a biased sample to start with, then we're committing the fallacy by making that claim. It's fallacious reasoning. We can't do that. We would have to say in our study that we only sampled male high school students. So we could say male high school students believe this or said this. And that would be avoiding the fallacy. Now, we're not necessarily committing the fallacy if we're just consumers of research and somebody committed the fallacy and we don't question it. We're just pretty much victims in that case of the biased sample fallacy. However, we could avoid that by looking into the numbers. Now, if we're just reading the paper or just going through Facebook or something and we just see something and it's not that big of a deal, like 9 out of 10 parachuters are scared when they're jumping out of a plane or something like that. It's like, okay, big deal. I'm not going to do all the research to find out exactly that sample and how it was done. And it's not that important to me. I don't care. That's interesting, but let's move on. But if somebody throws out these numbers of some kind of a very important social issue and research is done that could really change public opinion on a certain topic, well, then you might want to dig into that a little bit deeper. And you want to look up the actual study. And sometimes the studies are publicly available, sometimes they're not. If they are, what you want to do is you want to look in the methodology section of the paper, and you could generally see where the sample was chosen from, how many people were used, what the population is, and all the details about it. And then you could come to your own conclusion as to if the reporters of the information made the right conclusion. Very often they don't. You're much better off just to actually just read the study itself, just read the abstract of the study, and which is basically just the summary, the one paragraph summary of the study, and you'll get a very different picture than what the journalists want you to believe. So that's just a little tip when it comes to spotting a biased sample and actually what you can do about it. So that's pretty much it. When it comes to bias sample fallacy, just remember that sampling is very important. It's a very important part of social research, of any kind of research, in fact. It's a very important part of the scientific method, and it needs to be done correctly. And if it's not, well, it's a fallacy. The base rate fallacy is generally committed by people who are not familiar with statistics and base rates. And unfortunately, that's the majority of people, which could be dangerous. And there have been many court cases where people have been put to jail and maybe even put to death because the prosecutors and the judge and the attorneys did not understand this base rate fallacy. To give you an example of where the base rate fallacy comes in, let's say that you are studying heart attacks, and let's say television watching, or let's make it more interesting, video game effect on heart attacks. And you're dealing with just older men, ages 50 to 70. So you have a group of 50 to 70-year-old men, a large sample, who play video games for more than 3 hours a day. Now you take a look at that group and you find out how many of these men have heart attacks in, let's say, a 1 year period, those who play video games more than 3 hours a day. And after 1 year, our longitudinal study, we find out that 25% of all the men ages 50 to 70 who play video games more than 3 hours a day have heart attacks. And you could say, wow, that is terrible. Video games are horrible. They're from the devil. Let's get away from these video games, take them all off the market, or at least for older men. But what you're not doing is you're not considering the base rate. What is the base rate of 50 to 70-year-old men who just have heart attacks and forget about playing video games? This is why in research you use control groups. You use the test group and you use a control group. The control group would be somebody who's not subjected to the independent variable, which in this case would be playing video games. And then you compare the two groups, and then you'll be able to make a judgment. You'll be able to say, okay, now the people who did play video games happen to have a higher percentage, and you could determine whether it's statistically significant or not statistically significant. But the important part here is that base rate, is that control group. To look at that group that's not playing the video games, that actually is having the heart attack, and only then can you make a rational judgment on the effect of video games in relation to heart attacks on men aged 50 to 70 years old.